Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for you today. My guest will be Catherine Gill, and she is the investment and relations communication person over at Root Capital. She is the senior vice president there, and she is in charge of overseeing all the debt and philanthropy fundraising at Root Capital. And I'll have her tell us more about what she does and what Root Capital does in just a little bit. But before we do that, I want to go over some of the things that are going on in the news and some ways that you can take action. One thing that really got my attention this week was the front page of the New York Times, where they had the article about weight loss. And it was very interesting because it was a study that talked about body fat and how when we lose weight, very often our body manipulates our metabolism to slow down so that we can gain that weight back. And we're kind of like fighting against our own body. And I think this is a new piece of research that's really interesting. And personally, I know that I really read that article and it just felt true to me because I've been one that has always struggled with my weight my whole life. I grew up in a family of four kids and I was always the chubby one. And it was really hard. And I ate the same food as everybody else, but my metabolism was different than everybody else's. And, I exercise and I play tennis and I do yoga and I eat well and I still struggle with my weight, but I'm not into dieting. I'm just, I'm into eating real food and good food, and that's frustrating. So when I read that article about weight loss, it was just like, oh, come on. But anyway, it's a little bit comforting to those of us that struggle with it, even though, I don't know what the research is going to show. I mean, if it shows that your metabolism slows down, they want to give you drugs to speed up your metabolism, I don't think that's something that many of us would want to do anyway. So anyway, I just found it very interesting. Also, there was a great article about the Food Recovery Network, which is a wonderful organization that was started a few years back at the University of Maryland. Ben Simon was one of my guests on the show, and he was the founder of the Food Recovery Network. And this article was about the Food Recovery Network has made it all the way to the University of Hawaii. And they're gathering food there and, from many of the Hawaiian universities and then delivering that food to local homeless shelters. And it's really skyrocketing. They have lots of volunteers jumping on board and it's really an exciting thing. And the other thing I wrote about was this vegan burger for meat eaters. It's called the Impossible Burger. And I was at the Chef's Collaborative Summit a few weeks ago and that was one of the courses that they served at the Chef's Collaborative Summit. And as someone who hasn't eaten meat in over 45 years, it actually was weird for me to take a bite of this because it seemed so meat-like. And I've eaten many veggie burgers over the years. I actually love veggie burgers, and I make my own. But this burger seemed so meat-like. You squeezed it, it bounced like meat. The juice came out of it like meat. It looked red like meat. It was just weird. And I guess maybe it tasted like meat. I don't really know, but many people liked it. Some people thought it was just too weird, but it's all vegetarian and plant-based, and it's really a great thing for people who are, who really love their burgers and are trying to reduce their animal product intake. It's a great option, and it's going to be debuting this July. I know that it was presented to us through Bear Burger. I don't know what other burger places will have it or whether it's going to be exclusively offered at Bear Burger or what. But anyway, watch out for it because if you are a meat eater and the thought of giving up hamburgers is just too painful for you, this might be your solution. Also, I just want to encourage all of you to go on my website at ieatgreen.com and sign a couple of petitions. I have a great petition about the DARK Act, which I've talked to all of you about over many, many months. It's a bill in Congress to prevent states from having independent GMO labeling laws. And this is really important. I thought we had defeated it and that it was over, but no, it is back. And so we need to all let our senators know that we want them to support what the people want and not succumb to the pressure of big food companies like Monsanto and the Grocery Manufacturers Association. We really need to, let them know that the people, over 95% of this country, want GMO labeling. And so we have a right to know it's in our food. So keep up that pressure. Please sign the petition. Also, there's a question as to whether they're going to approve a new GMO mushroom, which would be just terrible. And right now it's going to the FDA for review. It's already gone through the USDA. And the FDA is looking at this mushroom and they want to approve it because it doesn't turn brown. Come on, people. What's wrong with a mushroom that turns a little brown? You're going to cook it anyway and it turns brown. If you're going to eat it raw, you're going to eat it when it's fresh and it's white. But come on. It just makes me crazy. And so this is what the people want. People want to know if our vegetables are genetically modified. We don't need any more products. With all the uproar of GMOs, why would the USDA and the FDA go ahead and approve another product? We need to stop them. So please sign the petition and let them know. And the last thing I want to have you sign is a petition to prevent ChemChina and Syngenta from merging together. If they get approval to merge together, they would be the largest GMO seed and chemical company in the world. So please sign on and let's keep that from happening. Just a few things going on in the New York area that I want to tell you about. This weekend is the New York Vegetarian Food Festival, and that's taking place at the Metropolitan Pavilion all day, all weekend long. So that's a really great event worth going to. Also, this May 7th is the 5th annual Riverkeeper Sweep, and this is an opportunity for people who want to help clean up the Hudson River and the shoreline. There's groups all along the Hudson River from Brooklyn all the way upstate New York. So you can go onto Riverkeeper's website at www.riverkeeper.org and sign up for a location near you. And it's just fun to get out and work together with people, and I actually think it's supposed to be a nice day. Also, May 12th is the Growing Farmers Initiative. The Stone Barn Center for Food and Agriculture is having a whole bunch of free workshops that are open to anybody. You just have to sign up. This one is a Growing Farmers Initiative, and it's really talking about the financials of farming and some of those details. So if you are a young farmer and this would be helpful for you, definitely worth checking out. Before I forget, I want to wish all the mothers out there Happy Mother's Day. That will be celebrated this weekend across the country. And so I wish all of you mothers a really wonderful, peaceful, and joyous holiday. And hopefully you won't be working too much and you'll be celebrated. May 14th, this is really exciting. Stamp Out Hunger Letter Carriers Food Drive. This has been going on for, 20 years, I think. But it's the largest food drive in the country, and the postmen pick it up. But this year, they've actually partnered with someone that I've interviewed, an organization I've interviewed called Amp Your Good. So normally, you can only leave out non-perishable items. But this year, if you want to make a donation, you can actually make a donation online at stampyourgood.com. And they will deliver fresh produce to the cities where they are represented. So Amp Your Good is partnering with the postal carriers, and they are actually going to bring some fresh produce as well. But anyway, that's May 14th. You just put food out in your mailbox, and the letter carrier will pick it up. So that's a great thing. May 15th, Panorama 2016 is taking place at Martha Clara Vineyards. And Dr. Michael Greger, who's author of How Not to Die, will be speaking as our keynote speaker. And then there will also be some other people talking about mindfulness and other wonderful transformational opportunities. Lunch will be served by Chef Noah Schwartz. And that's on May 15th. And you can find out more about it. Just Google Panorama 2016 and find out more about that. Let's see, May 19th, there's another Growing Farmers Initiative workshop taking place at Stone Barns. I just recommend going onto the Stone Barns website and seeing all the things they have going on there. It's really great. May 21st, March Against Monsanto is happening again. This year it's going to start in Union Square, starting at 12 p.m. That should be a great thing. You know, last year, was it already 2 years ago, the Climate March that took place in the city. We had over a million people. It was huge. So definitely check out the March Against Monsanto. And then just go onto my website and see all the things coming up. Two things I want to mention because I'm involved in. June 4th is a women's retreat taking place at the IE Green Homestead. It's going to be a vegetarian cooking class partnered with my daughter who's doing a dancing retreat. She teaches dancing with the elements. It's called the Metta Method. And she'll be dancing with the earth, wind, fire, and air. And once the workshop is over and there's some meditation, then we'll do a cooking class and then all sit down at a long farm-to-table luncheon. So that is taking place June 4th, and you can go onto my website to find out more information. And then the Long Island Food Coalition, which is a organization that is really just getting going after our food conference last year, we are going to have a tour of the North Fork, where we're going to be taking a coach bus from Nassau County and Western Suffolk County out to the North Fork. We'll be visiting Catapano Dairy, Widow's Hole Oyster Farm, and Green Porch Brewery, and sampling some goat cheese, some oysters, some fresh beer, having lunch at some food trucks, and then coming back. It should be really a fun day. So sign up for that too. And before I invite my guest on, I want to share my recipe with you. This week, the recipe is a chocolate flourless cake. And I don't do desserts that often because I don't encourage us eating desserts that often. But this is a great dessert that I made for Passover. And so it's also gluten-free. And it is really delicious. I still have some in my refrigerator. Believe it or not, I made this cake. We had 30 people at Passover, and there's still leftover. It's one cake, and I say that it feeds 16 to 20, but it's so rich, it can feed 30 plus, just because all you really need is a little sliver. Okay, so the ingredients. You need 1 pound of organic semi-sweet chocolate chips, 1/2 pound of unsalted butter cut into 1-inch sticks, 1/4 cup of Cafe Patron, and that's a coffee tequila, really delicious, 8 large eggs, 1/4 cup of organic sugar, 1 1/4 teaspoon vanilla, 1/2 teaspoon salt, confectioner's sugar just for the garnish, fresh raspberries for the garnish, and then you need some butter to grease the pan. So you're going to start by greasing a 9-inch springform pan with butter and line the bottom with some parchment paper. So just take a piece of parchment paper and cut it out to the size of the round 9-inch springform pan and place that on the bottom of the pan. And then you're going to take the pan and wrap it with tin foil up the side so that you make it waterproof. Because basically when we cook this, we're going to be cooking it in a roasting pan filled with water, and you don't want the water to seep into the cake. So you can start in your Hobart mixer or any type of electric mixer you have. You're going to combine the chocolate, the butter, the Cafe Patron. Oh, I'm sorry, the chocolate, butter, and the Cafe Patron are going into a double boiler, and you're going to melt that until smooth and creamy, and that takes about 5 minutes, and then you're going to set that aside. And then in your mixer, you're going to combine the eggs, the sugar, the vanilla, and the salt, and you're going to mix that up, and you're going to mix it for a while, like 7 to 10 minutes or so, until it doubles in bulk. And then using a rubber spatula, you're going to fold in 1/3 of the egg mixture into the chocolate mixture, and you're going to do that in thirds until it's all combined, and you're just folding it in. You don't want to take the air out of the egg mixture. And when that's all mixed in, then you're going to pour that batter into the springform pan, And you're going to place that springform pan into a roasting pan and pour boiling water all around the sides of the pan until it comes halfway up the sides. And bake it for 40 to 45 minutes. And you'll know it's ready when the edges of the cake start to set and they start pulling away a little bit from the sides. But it still will wiggle a little bit when you shake the pan. And you're going to remove the cake from the roasting pan and put it onto a wire rack and let it cool until it's room temperature. You can remove the foil, cover the whole thing with plastic wrap and refrigerate it overnight if you can. If you don't have time, at least you can refrigerate it for a couple hours. And then you're going to remove the springform pan. I run a knife around the edges first before releasing it. And then invert the cake onto a large plate so that you can remove the parchment paper so that people aren't eating that. And then re-invert it so that the top of the cake that you baked is the top of the cake. And you're just going to sprinkle that with some powdered sugar. I put the powdered sugar through a sieve so that it comes out not in clumps but looks really pretty. And I served it with some fresh raspberries and some vanilla ice cream. You can also do some fresh whipped cream. It's delicious. Like I said, it's definitely a treat. It's not an everyday food. So when you make it, enjoy it. And it's really delicious. And so now it's my pleasure to introduce to you my guest today, Catherine Gill. She is the Senior Vice President at Root Capital. And I'm going to let her tell us really more about what Root Capital does. But she manages their investor relations, the communications, and the marketing at Root Capital. And this is an agricultural lender that really provides money and services to growing agricultural businesses. And they're really making a difference. Since their start, they've helped over 2 million farmers. So, Catherine, are you with me?
I am. I'm right here.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So just to start, can you let my listeners know what is Root Capital? Like, where do you get your money? How do you invest? How did you get started?
Sure, absolutely. So Root Capital is a nonprofit organization. We're about 16 years old, and we are in the business of promoting incomes and stable employment for some of the world's poorest, most vulnerable people, i.e. farmers. What we do is we borrow money from what has come, we've come to think of as impact investors, people who invest their money with not just a financial return in mind, but also a social and an environmental return on that investment. We borrow that money, and then we re-lend it directly to businesses, agricultural businesses across Latin America and sub-Saharan Africa and in Indonesia. And these are businesses, could be a cooperative, could be a private enterprise, but they all share one characteristic, which is that they connect smallholder farmers with buyers, with markets. And they do that really efficiently, and there are all sorts of other benefits to that relationship.
Is that something, I know, in my circle, many people that I know are trying to, invest with impact, like you talked about, trying to divest from any fossil fuel companies, any pharmaceutical companies, and invest in areas that do make a social impact. Is Root Capital something that people can just invest in the same way they can call up, Morgan Stanley or Merrill Lynch, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so it's a great question, and it's one of the things that I love most about Root Capital and the model, if you will, that we employ, is that it's really accessible. We have currently about 220 investors, and the vast majority of them, say it's about 150, are individuals. And
really?
Some of them are individuals who come directly, they find us on the website, they listen to a podcast, whatever it is, and they say, yeah, I want that to be part of my portfolio. That's an expression of who I am, and so I'm going to put some of my investments to work. Some work with, like you said, with wealth managers or financial advisors or other third parties, if you will. And that is also super exciting because, for example, if you go to your advisor at Merrill Lynch and you say, hey, like, I'm interested in this, then the client of that bank or that financial advisor, that's you know, that's really important kind of data that they're getting from their clients about the kinds of products, the kinds of partnerships they need to be developing. And I think that is one of the most powerful ways in which impact investing can become sort of more mainstream, is that client demand can sort of educate the wealth advisors, those middle men and women, on what clients want. And I think especially as millennials start to be more involved in the conversations with their parents, that conversation is really heating up. You know, 5 years ago, we've talked to very progressive financial advisory firms for a long time, and there's an amazing network of those firms with such a richness on this level in the United States. But in the past 5 years, I've started to get phone calls from really much more mainstream investors that I would have never predicted that they would have been calling us. And that's because their clients are coming to them and they're saying, you need to do this to keep my business. You need to show me that you have products that are progressive. That's just such a cause for celebration.
That is really exciting. And I'm certainly going to go back, and I encourage everyone listening out there, if any of you are doing any investing, to go to your institutions that you're working with and tell them that you want to invest in an organization like Root Capital. It's great. So great. Right. Thank you for what you're doing. It's really exciting. Let's see. What is how does Root Capital decide who they're going to invest with? And does Root Capital, is your attempt to make money for people, or is it really more just to do good?
Yeah.
Because you know, some people can afford to just do good. They don't want to lose money, but they are happy to just keep it the same and do good. And then there's some people that really need to make their money work for them, and they're looking to also do it as an investment.
Yeah. So you kind of asked the $64,000 question. This is beautiful. It's a slightly complex answer, so let you tell me how I do in responding to it. We're trying to do so on the investor side, right? We work with investors, and we're really clear with them. We say, look, we're working in agriculture, and not only are we working in agriculture, we're working in smallholder agriculture. We're working in the sort of deep market failure. Right, the vast majority of the world's poor rely on farming for their survival.
Right,
and agriculture is not working for them. Right, so our belief is that businesses, cooperatives, for example, act as the great change agent for addressing that, because they can create the purchasing power by working with hundreds or thousands of farmers to connect to those global buyers. And by global buyers, I am talking about people that you have heard of. Right, we were talking about Starbucks, we were talking about Pure Green Mountain, we were talking about Whole Foods, we were talking about Costco.
Right.
We were talking about Jolly Green Giant. I mean, really, like, name brand. A lot of it is beautiful niche buying as well for things, you know, maybe things more like Kia or superfoods that are coming on the market. And that's also really exciting. But a lot of this is very, you know, we're talking about these businesses that big global buyers rely on for their product. And those businesses, they are the engines of change, of social and environmental impact in their communities. So we love that business. And so what we do is we're in about 25 countries. We have loan officers and staff full-time in about 10 locations from which we're covering those 25 countries. And they are, through their own networks, through peer-to-peer, referrals, through trade shows. You know, you were talking a lot about come to this event.
Right.
Those events are beautiful in marketing opportunities for our Root Capital, for our loan officers, because we get to know buyers and producers. And so through all of that sort of networking and that marketing, we find businesses that have it in their DNA, the DNA of their business model, to connect smallholder farmers, individual farmers, to markets. And that's kind of like the primary, criterion, if you will, at the top of the filter. And, you know, just to give you a sense of size, last year we worked with just shy of 300 businesses. And those 300 businesses represented 550,000 farm households. So we're talking about 2.5 to 3 million individuals. That's the sense of scale that we're operating on right now.
Mm.
So, sorry, and you were asking about how we use the money. So one of the sort of realities of working in that, you know, the hard part of that market, working in agriculture, where, you know, the margins in the business model are thin to begin with, is that the capital can be used to, you know, we can invest, but it's not going to work on its own. And so Root Capital has, I think, become a leader in using both investment capital and philanthropy, donations, grants, and blending those two together in order to achieve the highest impact. And if we were operating just with the investment, if we were just a lender, I think we would be limited in the impact we could have, because the nature of the challenges that our businesses are facing, sometimes they require a philanthropic mindset.
Right, I would think so. Just to get going, and like you said, then, you know, they're just covering their costs. They're, you know, it's so hard.
I mean, a great example of this is, one of the effects of climate change, of the warming of the planet that farmers are experiencing, is coffee farmers, for example, is that the altitude at which specialty coffee has historically been grown, it's changing. It's going up, right? So if you used to be able to grow really high quality shade-grown coffee at 800 meters above sea level, right? That's no longer the case. So those farmers, they are thinking about whether they have to rip up those coffee trees and they have to plant something else. And so, you know, there is an investable proposition in there. They're going to need a great financing partner, but they also need a technical assistance program. They need somebody who's going to sit with them to help them consider the opportunities for what to plant there based on what we think the climate is going to look like in that. So you need more scientific partners. You're not going to be able to do that. A lending institution that just takes an investment focus is not going to be able to have those kinds of resources. So we've raised grant funding in order to be able to provide that kind of technical know-how to our clients as they face those kinds of challenges.
Uh-huh. Wow, that's something you don't think about. You know, when you, with climate change, I mean, I've heard of so many other areas that climate change is going to affect, but if that's the land they own and it's at 800 meters, it's not like they have the choice to go up to 1,000 meters. They own 800 meters above sea level. So they have to find something that's going to work with that.
That's right. And so a lot of coffee farmers right now are talking about cocoa. So cocoa it thrives in a much hotter climate. But, you know, if you're a coffee farmer, you're a coffee farmer. And probably your parents were coffee farmers and your grandparents and maybe your great-grandparents too.
Right.
So the cultural change is massive. And so there's a lot in that transition. Not just tell me about how to grow a cocoa plant.
Uh-huh.
It takes a lot of grassroots work, community level work and change management to be able to manage that transition. And so supporting our businesses in the multifaceted ways that they need to manage that transition is huge.
Mm-hmm. You would think climate change is happening slow enough that the coffee beans could mutate, you know, to adapt to the climate, but I guess that's not happening, huh?
And some of them can, right? I mean, that's one of your options. You can change the type of coffee you grow. And certainly some of our clients would be making those choices as well. They're saying, I'm going to grow a slightly less high-end coffee. I'm going to get a lower price from it, but I'm going to save. And, you know, that would be one of the paths.
Uh-huh. Let's see. Do you know if Root Capital produces any of the food or products that listeners might consume? Of course, we've already just talked about that. Coffee and chocolate.
Go to Whole Foods. I think pretty much any coffee you buy at Whole Foods or at Starbucks or at Pete's, you know, and some of these other, you know, sorry to be sort of East Coast about it, but those are, or deep in the supply chains of those organizations, and also cashiers at Costco, for example, we do a lot. We're, you know, in that that buyer relationship in a pretty big way. I mentioned artichokes for Jelly Bean Giant coming out of Peru. So we work in, you know, 25 or 30 products every year. Coffee is the largest. It's about 50% of what we do, but cashews, quinoa, rice.
I was just going to ask about quinoa, of course.
Big time in the Andes, absolutely.
Right, and what's happening with, you might not know this, the answer to this, but I had read something about, you know, with quinoa, so much of it's now getting exported that the local indigenous people can't even afford it, and, you know, they're not getting the quinoa that they're growing now. How does Root Capital work with
that? Yeah, and I would say that the businesses that we work with are hyper aware of that as well. I mean, these are very, very high isolated communities that have suffered significantly from migration. So they're also under resourced from a human capacity point of view. And so the food security and nutrition angle is very real for those, the enterprises that are working in those environments. Because they often will have a quota. You know, they will not buy more than X percent of the crop. And so they've set up ways, you know, probably, you know, they're flawed in their own, you know, in a nuanced way, but structurally they're trying to address that through only buying, you know, say 70 or 80% of the crop to ensure that some of it stays in the house.
Yeah, because so often, you know, we hear about ways that we meaning the Western world, comes into these poorer countries bringing what we, our intentions are good, but very often the side effect is not always good for the local economy. Do you have people working on the ground to see how some of the investments are affecting the local people and what kind of impact that has on the countries you're working in?
Yeah, so I'm going to just make one more comment about quinoa and then sure. Answer your question, but just that and just remember that there was a good, you know, a survey that was done really recently. We could probably find it on NPR, maybe include the link or, you know, or the podcast, showed that they looked at this and saw that, I mean, really, farmers have gained immensely, quinoa farmers have gained immensely from the sort of growth of that as a specialty food product.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that.
The growth for the farmers. I mean, if you look at it strictly through a food security angle, you're missing part. We're missing part of the story, which is that if you look at it as an income story, the growth in that market has been hugely beneficial. So yes, they have more purchasing power than they had before, and I think, you know, Root Capital, we come back to income as kind of our as sort of the main metric, right? Working with smallholder farmers, connecting them to markets in order to drive more income, so more choice at the household level. And so that survey actually really underscored that hypothesis.
That's good to hear. Because, yeah, you hear about that all the time, and then you hear, you know, people ask me very often, what does fair trade mean? You know, because you know, lots of these, you know, like the chocolate companies, you know, even the big ones like M&M, Mars, or Nestle's might have a small portion that's fair trade, you know, so that they're caring about the indigenous people. But the vast majority of it is not being raised or sourced that way.
I think this is a really interesting point, and it's one that we're going to be continuing to, you know, monitor and talk about as we come. Like, there are a lot of certifications. And they're very useful, and they've been very useful in creating, you know, sort of creating the consciousness among the consumer, right? Here, I want to buy with my values. And I think maybe so much so that some businesses now feel like they have the opportunity to not have the certification, because you can do that, in other ways. Right, so some of that field building has happened. Certainly, the majority of our businesses have some sort of a certification, one or the other. But some of them don't. But all of them pass a pretty high bar that we as lenders set for social and environmental practices. And it isn't necessarily the case that the ones that have a lot of certifications are better.
Right.
And sometimes it depends on the supply chain you're working with. I mean, in certain supply chains, the certifications don't exist, right? Right, in more staple crops, for example. But it doesn't mean that those businesses can't be really progressive. And so this is something that I think we've become much more sophisticated in at Root Capital is kind of in the early years, we really relied on the certification as the proxy. We said, right, so they pass because they're for fair trade or they're whatever. But we realized that we were only capturing, you know, one part of the richness of the practices that those businesses were engaged in. And we wanted to understand it more comprehensively. So we actually spent, you know, quite a lot of time working with experts to build out a much more robust environmental due diligence practice. And then being able to tailor that for the different crops so that we are more educated so we can be better partners and not just use sort of a proxy approach, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so important. I mean, we all hear about greenwashing, you know, and in every, you know, because people have a consciousness now, many companies are taking advantage of that. I mean, I don't know if you read about the article when I was down at the food tank last week, you know, it was all the talk of the Tampa article on greenwashing that was happening at the farmers market and at restaurants, actually.
Well, I think there's greenwashing, and then there's also just certification overload, mm-hmm. right? Like, how do you navigate it? And so I think what we've done is just step back and say, let's define what we believe are the best practices and be able to have that conversation with the producers. And then engage in a continuous improvement process with them. So it's not binary either. Right? You're not saying, oh, you don't pass. You're saying, what are the challenges for you in this climate, in this crop? And help educate us so that we can be a great financing partner to you on how we might address this. Sometimes those become financeable products, or sometimes we can connect them with service providers that can help them address some of those issues. It breaks it open as opposed to, you know, making it a filter and a limiting. You know,
right.
Sort of limits the conversation. It opens it up.
Right. Well, you know, many, like you were talking about, companies that have it in their DNA to do social good, social change. And those you kind of like trust, like you said, because it's in their DNA, at least the founders, until they get bought out by one of the big giants, right? But then you have the big giants that you're also naming that you're working with, you know, and I'm wondering if Root Capital is one of the, you know, type of organizations that help them make those transitions. Like I always, you know, look twice when I see, you know, Dole pineapple that's organic or fair trade, or I see Chiquita banana, you know, and some of them are organic and some of them aren't. And how do you know which ones are and which ones aren't? And so, you know, would a big company like that be one of your clients that you might try to partner with someone and then that portion of their business becomes, you know, fair trade or organic or helping make the connection where the rest of it is still not up to par yet.
Absolutely. You know, the changes in corporate behavior and buying patterns are going to, they're going to drive this. Like they will be responsible for the thriving or the demise of small farms. So, and some of our ecosystems, right? And so I think Root Capital sees it as its job to have a high bar and holding on to that high bar to be the best sort of inside the supply chain partner to both the buyer and to the supplier. And I think this is maybe one of our sort of the things we've done the best over the past 16 years is working up and down. You know, we have our values on the wall here at Root Capital, right? One of our values multilingual. And we define multilingual as being able to operate with the same level of passion and acuity and tools in the boardroom as in the back rows in the legal house. Use that language, right? You have to be able to go to Mars or Nestle or Starbucks or Whole Foods or Walmart, and to present yourself as a partner for, as you know, a partner for driving their sustainability commitments.
Uh-huh.
Right? And we have to be optimistic about that. But then we have to hold on to the high bar because we have our clients on the other end, and we have to have pretty high, you know, criteria for what it means to preserve local ecosystems and to drive things like gender equality. And you know, we want to be exacting, but we also want to be useful.
Right. Well, you are, and I'm finding as I get more and more involved that I have to really challenge myself to be open to the corporations that I used to consider, I don't want to say the enemy, but you know, it wasn't in their DNA to care about the farm worker or to care about equality or equal pay or it just wasn't, you know, the social impact of how getting their product to market did not matter as long as they got it there as cheap as possible and made the most money. And the bottom line was all that mattered. And seeing that change and trusting corporations that weren't operating on that level, trusting them has been a real challenge for me in my own growth to try to trust them, you know?
Totally. And you know, we've got to be a little bit cynical, but not so cynical that we're not at the table.
Right.
Is maybe a way to say it. And the parallels to the first part of our conversation around that, working with, you know, people like Merrill Lynch or, you know, call them the big banks, it's a perfect parallel, right?
Right.
We have to be a little bit wary because big organizations are managing, you know, it's hard, right? I mean, it's really hard for a business like Walmart to meet its supply chain needs with that high bar. I mean, we have to appreciate that. But we have to be in the conversation. You know, we just have to be because I think Root Capital has to take the tools and the learning and the knowledge and figure out ways to make those useful to drive those businesses towards improved buying practices.
Yeah.
That's sort of our holy grail.
Uh-huh. Well, that's what I'm seeing more and more. As much as, you know, it's like, you know, I didn't want to give any more to, you know, World Wildlife Fund when I found out that they were partnering with, I forget now even, Dow Chemical, I think, you know, in doing something. I was like, what? You know, and yet I'm starting to understand how those partnerships can help to drive the change.
Exactly.
If, you know, you're getting young, more conscious people into those companies, and they're starting to make the change. So let's talk a little bit about food security.
Mm.
Is there a connection between the work that Root Capital is doing and the gains in food security in the regions where you work? How's that working? You know, we touched on it with the quinoa, but let's talk about that a little.
I'm glad you asked, because I would hate for listeners to walk away with the impression that Root Capital was working only in sport. Crops, if you will, most of the world's farmers, smallholder farmers, you know, two hectares or less under management, are not working in export. They're not working in a supply chain where the, you know, ultimate product is finding its way into a cup of Starbucks coffee.
Right. And actually, what's also surprised me is that most of the world still is being fed by those small farmers.
Yes. So on the one hand, you have export being really a small part of this. And on the other hand, you have the just irreconcilable, you know, in your heart kind of irony, which is that most of the world's forests are the people who are producing our food.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Food security is a real issue for most of our clients. We, about 6 years ago, we in earnest turned our attention towards being able to work with, you know, to a sort of diversification, if you will, and working more explicitly with businesses that were producing for local markets. And we've done this most kind of significantly in Africa, and in basic grains, maize, millet, sorghum, and also some fresh fruits and vegetables, and also in seeds. That's a really important one. Producers of hybrid, microclimate, kind of appropriate seeds for farmers. It's very hard sometimes for farmers to get good quality inputs, good quality seeds, and so there are some entrepreneurs who are trying to address that and serve that market, and is that hard work. And so we have, we've done probably 25-ish million dollars of lending into markets that would sort of fit that profile. And we think it's a big part of making progress. But it's super hard. it's small for us still, and we think it will grow, but there are some major challenges having to do with, for example, foreign currency, because you're not going to be lending in dollars. Mm-hmm. And so you would be lending in shillings or soles or, you name it. And we have not found a great way to manage the currency volatility. That I just sort of named that as one of the challenges that is preventing us currently from scaling that more as rapidly as we would like. That's a big part of the North Star for us, is being able to work with more of those entrepreneurs and cooperatives that are bringing nutritious food into local communities.
Uh-huh. Now you were instrumental in starting the women's initiative.
Yeah.
Can you talk about Root Capital's Women in Agriculture initiative that you started, and how is that a different program than what you normally do?
Yeah, we call it our Women in Agriculture initiative, and in a way it's not different from what we were just talking about. It's more of a lens that we apply to the work that we do. About 5 years ago, we started really, we just became more hungry to understand the ways in which women are benefiting from working in agricultural value chains and the ways in which they're not. And then turning that upon ourselves and saying, what could we be doing better or differently in order to address the barriers? So one of the ways, you've already touched on, is that by working in crops like maize or rice, you're almost sort of de facto working with women more than in coffee. Coffee is cash crops like coffee and cocoa tend to be very male dominated. They're big jobs, they're big industry, they're pretty well developed, and so the men have crowded into those historically. There are great exceptions, but they're exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
In other value chains, it's not true at all, right? So the great example that is always invoked, and it's worth invoking because it's a wonderful, shining example, is shea butter. Shea is a woman's crop. In West Africa, it's referred to often as women's gold. It's a big economic opportunity for many women living just sort of along the Sahel. And for historical reasons that I won't go into, but that are really interesting, that is true. So, when we started to diversify outside of, coffee, we became more gender inclusive. And then that gave us the opportunity to partner with those businesses to understand what are the barriers to increasing the participation of women in those businesses, and what could we do, what could we do differently? So, one great example of that is our technical assistance program. You and I haven't talked about that yet, but alongside our lending, we have a big technical assistance program where we, for free, right, using donations, we are working with our clients on addressing some of their capacity needs around management, around basic bookkeeping. Many of our clients are working on paper still, and that is, that's constraining them. So what we found is that being a kind of consultant, if you will, to these businesses on their accounting or their sales or, some of their other issues, often we had a much a different opportunity to engage with women within the business. And that a lot of the women you know, a lot of the sort of second in command or the thirds in command, if you will, in these businesses, they are women. It might not be a male, it might be a male head, general manager or entrepreneur at the top. But the head of accounting, there's this funny phenomenon where she's often a woman. And she has a sort of pint-sized opportunity to influence other women as a result of that, and to influence the women farmers. You know, I'll give you an example, right? Women farmers are behind men in terms of understanding the best agronomic practices, the best planting, pruning, fertilizing, right? And women are aware of that knowledge gap, women farmers are. And it makes the awareness, makes it hard sometimes for them to engage with a technical man, you know, the extension worker.
Right.
But if the extension worker is a woman, totally changes the game, right? And those women can catch up on that knowledge gap in a way that they just might not be able to. If the person, as well-intentioned as he might be, right? Is. And so, we actually wrote a little piece on this. We call these women the hidden influencers. And what we were trying to bring attention to is the fact that being a woman-led business, absolutely awesome, right? You want to find them, want to celebrate them, want them to grow. But it's not the only way that women can change the gender inclusivity, if you will, of those businesses. And we want to be really smart about the many ways that we can partner with businesses to make them, you know, better opportunities for women to have economic participation.
Right. And what about startup companies that are doing like added value, like canning or
hugely gender inclusive. And that was a big part of it. If you looked at our West Africa portfolio, for example, it's dominated by, you know, what we call agro-processing, right? Value add things like, you know, cashews I mentioned earlier, jellies, anything that where you're doing more of the processing. We talked about artichokes before. The vast majority of the jobs that are being created in those businesses are going to women. Often, those jobs are instead of jobs, you know, domestic jobs, house cleaning, very, very micro, you know, side of the road, selling, whatever.
Right.
This is a real leap for these women. To have structured employment like this, it's a real game changer in their lives.
Right.
And so that's and again, sometimes that's a male entrepreneur at the top of that business, but the job creation, the social story, is a job creation for women. And we're super excited about that.
And does Root Capital get involved in doing any of the training for people to start a new business? Like, do you kind of see sometimes where there might be an opportunity and try to encourage or draw, you know, gear the path that way?
We actually don't. Sorry. It's a great question, and it's a big need. And this is just one of those places where I think
you can't do everything.
We can't do everything, right. And so we rely on partners to do that, to do the launching, the organizing, if you will, of those businesses. And then we just try to be sort of, you know, their first financing partner.
Right.
That's where we enter the story generally.
Right. Because, you know, food waste has been so much in the news and something we talk about a lot. And in the countries that you're dealing with, unlike food waste here, where we're buying too much and we're just not conscious about it and we throw it out and waste it that way, in most of the countries you're dealing with, it has to do with the distribution and getting it to the market and getting it, you know, so that it doesn't rot on the field, or getting it into trucks or whatever.
That's absolutely spot on. And I think, you know, there are two interesting ways that that's showing up in our portfolio. One is, cooperatives, for example, will often be looking at the challenges, the shared challenges of their farmer members. And so, household silos, for example,
right.
It could be something that they would identify as a contributor to the waste that you just articulated. And so they might want to purchase bulk purchase home silos, and we could finance that. Right. So the business as a distribution into the countryside, you know, is one thing that we talk about a lot and we think is one of the huge values that these businesses, again, you know, why the business? Why are we not working at the farmer level? Why are we working at the business? And that's
right.
an example of why we think the business is kind of the thing. And the other one is, again, you know, into entrepreneurship outside of production, but in distribution, in storage. And we see some of that, not as much as you want, but some of that, for example, in East Africa, you know, in countries like Kenya, where the entrepreneurial culture is very, very strong, you would have businesses that are doing, that are addressing, you know, storage, for example, more
right.
storage outside
right.
of the home.
Well, I just have to say, I mean, we're just about out of time, but I'm really so happy that you came on and, you know, shed light onto this and introduced Root Capital's work to my listeners, because I think so many of us are looking for ways to invest with impact and to, you know, to bring our values to our money. We always hear about, you know, shopping with your, you know, your dollars, or, you know, your fork with your dollars. And, you know, this is just another extension of that. And so thank you so much. Can you share with everybody the website if they want to find out more information?
Absolutely. So let me just say that, you know, right back at you, thank you for this introduction. I think you and I care about a lot of the same things, and we care about a lot of the same things as your listeners, and both on the investing side and the purchasing side, there's a lot we can do with our dollars to drive this change.
Yeah.
It is perhaps the most powerful lever we have at our disposal, and we have to continue to use it, you know.
Absolutely.
To its maximum. So thank you for that. We can be found at www.rootcapital.org. Super, super straightforward. We would also love to invite people to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and to join our newsletter. All of those things are super easily found on the website. You can jump in on it. But we are trying to talk about a lot of these same topics that you brought up today. So we'd love to cross-pollinate.
Thank you so much.
Those
thank you. And everybody out there, thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network with my guest, Catherine Gill from Root Capital. Have a great rest of the week. Have a great Mother's Day. And I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.